They came from behind to beat the Nationals 9-8 last night to win the division series. Cubs now advance to the championship series against the Dodgers, game one tomorrow night in Los Angeles. The American League Championship Series opens tonight, Yankees and Astros in Houston. That's a 7:08 start. NFL Thursday Night Football, Philadelphia beat Carolina 28-23. Sunday, Packers and Vikings at noon from Minnesota, Bears and Baltimore also at noon. NHL, Blackhawks lose to Minnesota 5-2. And in high school football, WGTD Sports Live on Facebook, Indian Trail and Horlick. Over on GatewaySportsWeb.org, it is Bradford and Case, both games 7 o'clock. The forecast now from the National Weather Service for this Friday, the 13th. Cloudy and seasonal, high is 67. Rain moving in tonight, rain most of the day tomorrow. Tonight's low 58, tomorrow's high 70. Right now, 58 degrees. At 10 and a half minutes after 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we are looking ahead to Tuesday's special mayoral election in the city of Racine, an election prompted by the resignation this past spring of Mayor John Dickert. The two candidates are Republican Sandy Widener, an alderwoman for the 6th District of Racine, and Democrat Corey Mason, state representative for the 66th District. We extended invitations to both candidates to join us for interviews. Mr. Mason accepted our invitation. Sandy Widener regretfully declined, citing her schedule. The interview that you are about to hear with Corey Mason was conducted by WGTD General Manager David Cole.
Okay, Corey, what's your vision for the city if you get elected?
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be the next mayor of Racine. We've got amazing things happening for us. But my vision for the city of Racine is one where the middle class is thriving again. We've got a lot of jobs coming nearby, and we need to make sure we have residents that are trained and ready to do those jobs. We have a great set of schools here in town. We need to keep those together, and we need a place where we're continuing to protect the environment. And my vision of Racine is an inclusive community where everyone can succeed regardless of their background. So, but broadly speaking, it's a place where the middle class thrives the way it once did and prepares to really succeed in the 21st century.
And what does that look like in terms of what kind of preparations need to be made, you know, within the workforce in order to make that happen? I'm a lot different than, you know, what the workforce had to do 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's not your grandfather's factory job, that's for sure. So it's amazing opportunities with all the infrastructure coming nearby, with the building that needs to be done, and with the high-tech jobs that are coming our way. So the city is really going to have to lead on job training and getting people in our community who are, you know, good workers who are but maybe underskilled and undertrained into the training programs so that they can be building that infrastructure or into those training programs with Gateway so that they're ready to do the jobs that are going to be available that are coming to our community. But that's going to take a mayor who really has a vision to move the community forward in that direction, really marshaling our resources, partnering well with Gateway and the building trades and the county and going after state and federal resources to make sure that we can take advantage of this great opportunity that's coming to our area. Because if we don't, you know, I mean, the factory they're talking about building is only a few miles out of the city. But if we don't train our workers to prepare for it, it may as well be 100 miles away. So the next mayor is going to have to make job one training people to do the jobs that are coming to our community. Because without the training, they won't be able to do that work. And we have to get our people prepared to do it. And if we do, I mean, I know this community is as well as anyone. People here work hard. And if you give them the training and the opportunity, they will succeed. But we've got to give them the training and the tools so that they can do that.
So specifically, what do you envision the role of the city as being? What can the city do that it isn't doing already?
Yeah, so we can partner with groups like First Choice Pre-Apprenticeship or other groups like Big Step that have a really good model about how do we get people who are trained into a point where they can, for example, get into the building trades and start pouring concrete and swinging a hammer and doing the work of rebuilding the interstate and rebuilding factories and extending our water utility. That takes some work, but it's really a place for the mayor to step in and marshal those resources together and say, okay, how do we get to a place where we're not just training dozens of people a year to get into the building trades, but hundreds? How do we get to a place where we can take advantage of the 10,000 construction jobs that are coming our way? To do that, you got to get people ready and skilled up to do that. So that means usually getting them to a place where they can take care of some basic math skills and be prepared to go into the trades. And if you give them that opportunity, they can be to a place where they'll make enough money to survive on and, you know, support a family. And those are really important things. The other thing that the city can really do is marshal resources and partner with the school district and Gateway to figure out, okay, what are these jobs that are coming to our community? And we really need to make sure that those engineering jobs and those computer science jobs are jobs that our community has been trained to do. The city can marshal the resources to make sure that we've got more people that would otherwise be ready to work in that facility. I mean, because if we don't, we know those employers are going to go look elsewhere for them. They'll go to Milwaukee or they'll go to Chicago even to find the workers they need. We need to be there when they open on day one with a pool of qualified candidates locally so that we can really enjoy the benefits of all these jobs coming to our community.
From your vantage point, is there anything that either Racine Unified or Gateway could be doing differently or be doing more of?
Well, you already hear about it. I mean, we're going to double the size of the IMET facility out in Sturtevant and enhance the computer science programming out at the Lakeshore campus for Gateway. I mean, the technical college is very good about sort of getting prepared for the jobs that employers say they need. We just need as a city to make sure we're getting our residents into those programs, finding where those places are. And that means working with Racine Unified. That means working with the city's community centers and really reaching down into the community and finding people who are good workers who, you know, maybe have a long work history but haven't been making a whole lot of money, who might think, you know, I'd really like an opportunity to make a living wage and even a really good middle-class wage at one of these facilities. It's a phenomenal opportunity. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but we really need a mayor who can seize that opportunity to rebuild the middle class here in Racine.
Well, we're on the topic. What is your take on Foxconn in general?
Well, in general, I mean, who wouldn't be excited about tens of thousands of jobs coming to the area? I mean, there are things about the deal that I don't like. I certainly don't like the environmental exemptions that they've written in there. But in general, I mean, I can tell you as somebody who's been knocking on doors in this community for 12 years, what I hear more than anything is people saying, when are good middle-class jobs coming back to our community? I talked to one gentleman who said he would give anything for the wages and benefits that he had working in a factory in the 1990s. He's been working since then, but with no benefits and no pension. I talked to another woman who's got a job. In fact, she's got two of them. And she's a single mom, and she's trying to figure out how she's going to raise her daughter. And she'd really like the chance to have a job that paid enough to raise her family. I talked to another union carpenter who said that, you know, too many of their members have been on the bench waiting for infrastructure work to come along. He'd really like the opportunity to have the chance to help build that facility. So what I hear from workers and people in our community over and over again is they really want good jobs. This is the biggest jobs announcement of my lifetime. But again, we only get to fully take advantage of it if we've got a change in leadership at City Hall and have somebody in there who can really take advantage of this opportunity.
Other than doing what it can to make sure the workforce is there, it looks like the city of Racine's only direct involvement would be with water. Is that your take on this?
Yeah, the city of Racine will have a conversation to have with our neighbors about the amount of water that Foxconn is going to need. And so certainly there's going to be discussions that the next mayor is going to have to facilitate. And certainly making sure that that mayor is making sure that Lake Michigan is protected in that process and that we're not handing over water in a way that would adversely affect Lake Michigan is going to be critically important moving forward, no doubt about it. But, you know, it also creates other opportunities for redevelopment in the city of Racine. So I would love it if all the jobs went to people who currently live in Racine, but some of them might not. And as people move to the area to do these jobs, I think a good mayor needs to make sure we're thinking through, well, where are the places we'd like new residents to live? And are there economic development opportunities either on our lakefront or in West Racine or other places that'll be close to the facility that might be a really good place where new residents want to live? We're going to have to work hard to market that. But then the other thing is we've heard much discussion that it's not just going to be Foxconn. It's going to be an entire industry that's coming here. The next mayor needs to make sure that we're doing everything we can to identify local businesses that could be suppliers to this business and making space available for available secondary market businesses that might want to start here and begin to work with Foxconn. We've got some industrial land in the city, and if it's going to be just a few miles away from the Foxconn facility, you've got to have a plan in place to go get those businesses so that they can thrive and grow in the city of Racine as well.
But back to the water issue, do you have any environmental concerns in terms of the expectation that the city would be supplying the whatever it is, 8 million gallons of water a day?
Well, I think the next mayor needs to make sure that those environmental concerns are met, right? I mean, we can't do something that, I mean, we have done so much in the city of Racine to restore North Beach and to really do everything to protect Lake Michigan. We cannot and we will not do anything that would jeopardize to the return flow or wastewater or anything else that Foxconn would need that would jeopardize Lake Michigan. You're going to need to have a mayor who's going to insist on that when we have these discussions with water, with Mount Pleasant and Foxconn.
Okay, well, let's switch gears just a little bit here. Let's talk a little bit about the arena project. You've come out against that, but are there any situations that could develop that could potentially, make you a supporter of the arena?
No. I mean, look, the arena costs too much money, far more than the city could afford. It doesn't have any private investment, and people really are opposed to it. And for anybody out there, the few of them that remain who think it's something the community should do, I would invite them to knock on doors with me for a day and just hear the opposition to it, whether you are on Marquette Street in closer to downtown, or you're on the north side of William or the south side by St. Lucie's. People are saying over and over again, they don't want this. And if you're going to have something like this in your community, you have to have buy-in from the people who would be paying for it. And they have resoundingly said they do not want an arena. So based on what I'm hearing from people who would be paying for it, the taxpayers, and what I'm seeing from the plan itself, which just is not financially viable, we need to close the chapter on the arena and move forward. Now, I know my opponent really wants to make this election about that, but the only candidate in this race who's voted to spend any money on the arena is my opponent. So I've heard loud and clear from people that they oppose this idea. I've looked at the finances of it. They don't make sense. We really need to close the chapter on the arena and move on to what's next and get our workers prepared for the jobs that are coming to town.
What would happen if some private investment would materialize down the road here?
Well, sure. I mean, if some private investor came in and said they wanted to pay for it all, then the private investor can pay for it all. But asking city taxpayers to bear all the cost of an arena is just unsustainable. And again, look, if some private developer wants to pay for it all, great. It's a free country, have at it. But what's on the table now and what's being discussed is whether or not the city should pay for an arena. And the answer to that is a resounding no.
What's your analysis of the Machinery Row development? I mean, that essentially is at a standstill at the moment. What's your analysis?
Machinery Row is a big part of the reason I'm running for mayor, actually. So, 5 years ago, approximately, the city came to me and said, if you could work with Republicans to pass an historic building tax credit bill, we think that we could find a developer that would redevelop Machinery Row, these historic buildings that are right down there on the river. And so I worked very hard at that, reached across the aisle and worked with Republicans and actually convinced them that this was a worthy cause. And we actually passed an historic building tax credit bill. And the city was able to give the developer $9.7 million in redevelopment credits. And then the city completely dropped the ball. They lost the developer. It's not moving forward. And so now instead of a project being $10 million ahead, it's $6 million behind because the city's left paying for the buildings and having to do the cleanup. And because they didn't really watch it for the last few years, there's now a discussion that they might have to tear the buildings down altogether. The city needs to be able to do good economic development projects in the world, in the real world, and they have not been able to execute those. And Machinery Row is another example of it. I really want to see good development projects happen in the city, but they haven't been able to do that. And Machinery Row is a cautionary tale of what happens if you don't really work hard to make developments happen successfully.
Now, those historic tax credits you referred to, they did not make it out of the legislature and the governor's office in this budget. Is that correct?
That is correct. So those credits are now gone. So it's not like the city could go back to the state and reapply for them. The city missed its window to leverage $10 million in credits to rebuild its waterfront. And that's just, we can't let that happen again. It's part of the reason we really need a change in City Hall. If we could look to our north, Oak Creek is doing all these economic development projects. We look to our south, Kenosha is doing all these economic development projects. And people are constantly saying, why can't we have good projects here? And the only real reason is that we need a change in leadership at City Hall to see these things through to fruition. And I'm not saying they're easy. They take a lot of work and a lot of patience. You've got to work hard to go after state and federal resources to help pay for these things. But gall darn it, we are going to have real economic development in the city of Racine when I'm mayor, because we have to. There's just too much at stake to get passed over by another generation. As Kenosha moves ahead, as Oak Creek moves ahead, as businesses come to town, we are not going to be the last generation to achieve the middle class in Racine. But to do that, we need a new mayor.
And the historic tax credits, that's why Gorman stepped in initially, correct?
When they thought there was a possibility of it, of them still being there, they were interested. But once they were gone, just about anybody looks at the finances and says, well, it doesn't work without the tax credits. And again, because the city was remiss in securing the buildings, they're now going to have to come down. You can't replace those buildings, right? So it's really frustrating to lose almost $10 million in credits and now see the city $6 million in the hole because of the mismanagement of that project. We've got to have a change in leadership. And we've got to succeed in the real world.
Just to provide some background on this, the original developer looked very promising, but then things happened where he just wasn't meeting deadlines, correct?
Yeah, I mean, regardless of how it happened, the city entered into this arrangement with the developer and needed to work out getting it done, and that didn't happen. So, again, you need a mayor who can see projects through. I remember somebody early on in the campaign saying to me, I just feel like Racine has project fatigue. We're just tired of hearing about all these things that never happen in the real world. And I think that's right. I think people want to know why it is that our surrounding communities can move ahead and we can't. And it's just going to take some dogged determination and some new leadership in City Hall to see some changes happening in the real world so that we can grow our community and move our community forward.
And do you think that Foxconn's presence will help change this, the status that you just spoke of?
I do. Look, I think change is coming, and I think maybe more so than some voters realize. Foxconn's entry into Racine County is going to change things substantially in the Racine area, and so we have to be ready for it. We have to make sure that we can do smart economic development projects. We have to make sure that if they're going to get our water, they're not going to do a single thing to hurt Lake Michigan. And we need to make sure that the workers are trained and ready to work there. But it is something that is going to change the future of the city of Racine. And we really need dedicated leadership to make sure that our folks have the opportunity to take advantage of the jobs that are here and to encourage people to want to live in the city.
Other than Machinery Row, is there anything over the last several years that you would have done differently had you been mayor?
I mean, I think that there's a real challenge around inclusion and diversity in our community. If you look at some of the disparities that exist, whether it's around infant mortality, which is way too high, if you look at wages, if you look at employment, it's just too high. And we've got some real pockets of poverty that exist in our community. One of the things I would have liked to have brought attention to, and that I will bring attention to when I'm mayor, is we've got to address the needs of people who are living in poverty in our community to get them out of poverty. I mean, we've really got to get to a place where there's no government program that works better than a good-paying job. And with so many jobs coming to the community, we really need to focus on what is it that holds people back from moving out of poverty. Is it job training? Is it housing? Is it access to health care? What is it? Those are the kind of things that I really would like to focus on, so that we look at our city that's inclusive and it's a place where everyone can succeed. The other thing that I really want to bring attention to is this. For too long, Racine has been number one or number two in unemployment in the state of Wisconsin. That is a trend that has to end. And if we have the right leadership in place, it will end. But since I can remember, Racine has always been first or second in unemployment. We have got to move forward and get people trained and into jobs that pay enough so that they can raise a family. And those are the kinds of issues I really want to bring attention to when I'm mayor.
And how do you get people excited about those employment opportunities?
Well, I mean, I think you have to present them with the opportunities that are there. I don't think it takes much to get people excited. When you talk to somebody who's, you know, been making $8 or $9 an hour for the last 20 years, and they hear about the possibility of working in the building trades for, you know, three times that with health care and benefits, or they hear about, you know, a computer science or technician job at Foxconn that will pay on average $54,000 a year plus benefits, people get pretty excited. I have a lot of people asking me, well, where do I go to sign up? What do I have to do? And so I don't think it's going to take much to get people excited. What we've got to do is give people real opportunities so that they can take advantage of those jobs that are coming to the community.
Just one more question. I want to slip this one in. What's your analysis of city finances? Are they on solid ground?
So the city could do more to reduce its debt. And for the first time this year, they actually made a substantial payment to reduce the debt from $101 million to $97 million. That's a good trend. I was surprised that my opponent voted against paying down that debt. We've got to be in a place where our fiscal house is in order, and we've got to have a good bond rating. But to be clear, my opponent voted no when she had the opportunity to reduce our debt. That's a trend that is a bad place to be. And if I'm mayor, we're going to make sure that we're on sound financial footing as a city.
Corey Mason is the Democratic candidate for mayor of the city of Racine. He spoke with WGTD General Manager David Cole. We extended the same invitation to the Republican candidate in the race, Alderwoman Sandy Widener. She declined our invitation, citing her schedule. Last night, a candidates' forum was held at Racine's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center. A number of different issues were discussed, including housing, jobs, immigration, the opioid crisis, and their respective visions for the city and its future. There was a lengthy discussion on the proposed downtown arena that would house sporting and entertainment events. WGTD News Director Dave McGrath has this report.
There was a mayoral debate in Racine last night. Both candidates agree that the public does not want a downtown sports and entertainment complex, but they continue to jab at each other on the issue that remains part of the budget and city planning process, at least for now. Before a crowd of more than 100 people at the King Center, State Representative Corey Mason called it a dead issue and said it's time to close the arena chapter and move on.
I am in a better position to convince my colleagues on city council to give up the ghost and move on. They cost too much money, there's no private investment involved, and people don't support it. And for the aldermen who are still wondering, I would invite them to knock on doors in their district for a day and ask people what they think, and they would find out that people don't support it.
Mason's opponent, Alderman Sandy Widener, agreed with him, but then got into the political weeds about the issue.
If The other 18 dissent that is in support of it had all the facts about what it was going to cost the taxpayers. They would be opposed just as well, because when push comes to shove, I think there are too many people serving on the city council that like their seat, and they're not going to be willing to give it up for that event center.
The winner of Tuesday's election serves out the rest of John Dickert's term, starting November 7th and running through April of 2019. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath.
We want to remind you that this special mayoral election in the city of Racine is occurring this coming Tuesday, October 17th. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's program with Brian Gill, Assistant Professor of Acting at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and the director of a production that is opening there tonight. It's one of the great classic comedies, Molière's Don Juan.
When I was given the choice, you know, what plays are you interested to direct, I thought, well, it would be great to do a Molière, because he's not done a lot. And I thought about the play, and I thought, yeah, let's do that one. Because there is so much opportunity for as you say, I mean, for laughter. It's a very funny play, right up until it's not. You know, it takes a real sharp turn towards the end. But it's just a lot of fun, and it is. It's really funny.
Mm. You know, even all these centuries later.
Absolutely. I mean, it's frighteningly modern in a lot of ways.
Interesting. One of the intriguing things about this work is the enormous controversy that it generated at the time, and it's not the only play by this Frenchman that generated controversy. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the playwright himself, the times in which he lived, and what made so much of his work such a lightning rod for criticism and controversy, and also great acclaim.
Absolutely. I think the thing that I, as a performer, respect the most out of Molière was, you know, he supposedly, it was one of these, he's going to take Paris by storm, you know, this young performer, and he bombed profoundly. Mm. And then he went away. He toured, you know, the sticks, and learned his craft, and learned his playwriting craft and his acting craft. And then, I think it was like 12 years, he just worked at being a playwright and an actor, and then came back to the court and became this huge, you know, very controversial, but this huge sensation. Hmm. And he, you know, he doesn't pull his punches. And with Don Juan, which is the third play in the Hypocrisy trilogy, which is School for Wives, Tartuffe, which is of course the famous one, and then Don Juan, and I mean it was produced in 1665, and then was pulled, you know, the play was withdrawn after 15 performances, because he was just going for the jugular, mm-hmm. in regards to the level of hypocrisy that he was seeing. And it was that, and it was one part, the controversy was that his critics felt that he was celebrating this legendary libertine. Mm. This play was a disaster for him. And it didn't show up again until 1683. So there was a censored version that went round. But
And that's 10 years after Molière's death.
Yeah. So, you know, and of course, what I love is the original version of the play showed up in Amsterdam, which just amuses me, because, you know, his critics were so, how dare you, and you can't call people out like this, kind of a thing, you know, because of course he was pointing his finger at the very people who were criticizing him, all of these people that he felt were profoundly hypocritical. Mm. I find that very, very interesting.
Yeah, there's a very direct correlation between who this play was aimed at and
right.
those who raised the most sort of fervent cries of criticism.
Absolutely, this nest of vipers that he was in the midst of, you know, that were established in the court.
Mm.
And I love that he says it seems that his reaction when the king called him to the carpet on this thing was, the play takes place in Sicily. What are you talking about?
Hmm.
You know what I mean? It's not in France. This is Italy.
Right. You know? So as if that would be enough to
exactly. Yeah, I'm sure the king saw it right through him.
Right. Well, it kind of makes you wonder, too, if the playwright was courageous or naive or foolish.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, surely he had to have some sense of the kind of fate he was tempting.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, he was in real tight with the king, so I'm sure he was somewhat protected because of his personal relationship. But, I guess it's that thing that makes artists, and especially brilliant artists, dangerous. Mm. You know, they see something and they point it out. Mm. And if it's, you know, if you're the hypocrite that's being called out publicly, you're not going to like that.
Mm. I understand that there are multiple versions of this play. I mean, that we do have access to the original,
right.
but other sort of standardized versions, heavily edited,
exactly,
appeared at different, yeah, and even different versions, prose versus poetry, and so on. So, is it tricky to sort through all that? And can I assume that what Parkside's presenting is something that at least closely resembles the original?
Yes. Yeah. I wanted to do his play. I didn't want, you know, in my mind's eye, you know, some royal censor's version, you know, with all the good stuff taken out.
Hmm.
So I looked for a translation that was close to, you know, to this controversial end of Western civilization as we know it kind mm-hmm. of play, you know.
So this is just after Shakespeare, about 50 years after mm-hmm. Shakespeare. So, for instance, what is the language going to sound like? I mean, and obviously mm-hmm. it's not Molière's original French. We're going to hear it in English. Is it going to sound like old English? Are we going to have to listen to this with sort of special intensity, the way we typically have to listen to Shakespeare or mm-hmm. something like it in order to understand what's going on?
Right. I mean, the play is in prose completely. It might be his only play that is entirely in prose. There is a feel. It is heightened language, but you know, one of my missions in life is to access this kind of language, you know, because it's you know, like as you say with Shakespeare, you know, this myth that he somehow wrote in a foreign language, because we've all had a bad experience with Shakespeare. I mean, we still use something ridiculous like 87% of the exact same language that the Elizabethans and the Jacobeans use.
Hmm.
So, you know, I always work with my actors and encourage my actors to play it real. You know, there are times that you have to find the cadence, and there's times that you have to really use, your articulatory mechanism to sound fancy. But you know, you have to chew on this language. We're 21st century English speakers are profoundly lazy in the way that we communicate, and that doesn't translate on the stage.
Right.
But it's I want to say heightened language. That'll make people kind of wince, but I think it's imminently followable.
Okay. So we'll hear something of "Methinks it was the blah blah blah."
Yeah, no, it's not even that. It's not even that kind of level of Wayback Machine. You know, heightened language is the only
sure.
way that I can kind of define
it. So it's not going to be a kind of our lazy everyday ordinary kind of language.
No, it's a good translation in regards to Albert Bermel. Modernized it to a way, but I mean, it's definitely not going to sound certainly alien to our ear, and I think people will be pleasantly surprised at how modern it sounds.
Great. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking to Brian Gill, who is the director of the University of Wisconsin Parkside's production of Molière's Don Juan, which is opening this weekend and running for
two weekends.
Ahead of us talking about the plot,
Let's talk for a moment about the legend of Don Juan. You've already mentioned Mozart's Don Giovanni, which, of course, is one of the most famous retellings of this legend, but it's just one of many, of course. Although all of us know in a vague sort of way, at least, who Don Juan was, is in this legend, maybe you can speak even a little bit more specifically and maybe help us understand the sort of elements of that legend that seem to have been the most significant catalysts for this play taking shape.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the idea of the great seducer, you know, this man who is an expert swordsman and a great romancer, and I think that's what it is for him. I mean, I think he's got this great line in the play where he's justifying his horrendous behavior, and the line that always I think of is, whatever happens next, happens. You know, but this you know, this man who is just led by his desires. Now, what Molière does is he turns it into a scathing indictment of hypocrisy. There's a chilling point in the play where Don Juan realizes, I can use hypocrisy to get away with anything. And in fact, if I do this right, people will defend me for my terrible behavior. And it's a really interesting study in what happens when the person who has the power, in this case Don Juan, because he's an aristocrat, what happens when the person who has the power has no moral code whatsoever? And I mean, the adults have truly left the room. And also how that affects the people who are underneath the person in power who has no moral code. His servant Scannerelle, which is a character that Molière played in many plays, that was kind of his signature character, is constantly checking in with the audience and saying, I hate myself for this. I can't believe I'm doing this.
Right, being associated
exactly.
with this guy.
But what do you do, you know, when you've got someone who is a very charming but an absolute villain who's in charge and signing your paycheck? You know, how do you find your moral code and that foundation to fight against it?
Right. Boy, you were saying earlier how sort of disturbingly timely this play is. And I'm thinking particularly, of course, of the unbelievable headlines out of Hollywood this week about Harvey Weinstein.
Yep.
And years and years and years and years of the most morally bankrupt behavior.
Absolutely.
We can imagine. And of course, it's exactly what you were just saying. When somebody has that amount of power that he especially once did in Hollywood,
absolutely,
combine that with a very sketchy moral code, if he had one at all,
right?
And you just have this recipe for kind of human catastrophe.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, what happens when, you know, and I mean, it's you can get all very, it's sometimes dangerous with the older plays to get very kind of, post-Freud, you know, kind of psychological. But, you know, I mean, narcissists are dangerous. And when you are that kind of person and you have that level of power, I mean, who was going to tell, you know, you mentioned Harvey Weinstein, who was going to tell him, knock it off?
Right.
Do you know? And again, when the person who's supposed to be the grown-up is incapable of behaving like a grown-up, it's a fascinating recipe for disaster, and for the theater, it's brilliant conflict. You know, especially when you find yourself hearing things from Don Juan, and you go, "Oh dear God, we've all had those moments where we've at least thought about it."
Right.
You know,
but he has the shamelessness
to live it out.
Yeah,
brazen, absolutely brazen. His hypocrisy speech is truly, it's disturbing, And it is several hundred years old. Hmm. And I'm sure it was disturbing in 1717 and 1817 and 1917. And here we are, 2017. Hmm. And it could have been written last Tuesday.
Wow. The play is in five acts. Can we assume that this is a fairly lengthy play?
Not remotely. With intermission, it's going to come in probably around 2.5 hours.
Oh.
It's just the way that it was structured. So our act one is Molière's acts 1, 2, and 3. Hmm. And then our act two is 4 and 5. And so it's front loaded. 4 and 5 are 4 is pretty short, and 5 is very short.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
You touched on the fact of kind of the kernel of the conflict of Don Juan and these two past loves, or loves is even the wrong word, conquests.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, current. He's on the make for both of them.
Sure.
Yeah, right at the moment.
And then someone new that on whom he has set his sights. Tell us a little more about just exactly what happens. I mean, you don't have to go right to the very end, but give us some sense of where we go over the course of these five acts.
Yeah, well, I mean, he starts the play married. He spotted a young. I think if she was not a nun, she was well on her way to be a nun. He spies this woman, Elvire, in a convent. This is all exposition. Molière is great in letting you know what happened. Off stage, so he hatches this plan to kidnap her from this convent, and then marries her, and then reality starts kicking in, and he wants a new one, so he hatches this new plan because he's seen this other woman, and he's going to she and her fiance are about to take an ocean cruise. So he's gotten a bunch of pirates together, and they're going to board the ship and kidnap her. And en route to doing that, there's a storm, of course, because all good plays should have a storm. And again, this is all exposition. And they're capsized, and he's rescued by a peasant. And then he sees this young peasant woman. And then he sees this other young peasant woman. And he's working the both of them. And Molière was very influenced by Commedia dell'arte, which is very physical comedy. It's linked to Marx Brothers and the Three Stooges, all that knockabout kind of humor. So this scene transpires where he's putting the moves on Charlotte, who's played by Hannah Anderson, and then Maturin comes in, played by Rain. Hello, come on now. Kleinhoffen, sorry, Rain. And they realize, what's going on here. And what was really just wonderful about the whole rehearsal process for me was I've got Rain Kleinhoffen and Hannah Anderson and Shane Richland in those roles. And they've been training with me for 3 years. And they're very good at physical comedy. And they are hysterical. And they are just physically good comedians. So, Shane's picking Rain up, and it turns into a brawl, and it's very slapstick. And it was so much fun to watch these three actors and artists figuring this stuff out. I had this moment in rehearsal where I'm watching them, and I chose to say, play, let's figure this out, because they all have stage combat training. They're all just very, very good actors, and I trust them. So I said, let's see what's going on. And I'm watching them, and they're figuring stuff out, and they're trying stuff, and it's working. And then I say, okay, that's good. Let's craft this moment. Let's do this. Actually, that suggestion is better than mine. Brilliant. I'm claiming credit. And then I had this, all of a sudden it hit me. It's a new experience for me that I've been with these folks for 3 years, which is the longest I've been with a class, and they're doing it and they're ready and we're having so much fun. And come May, I have to say bye, so that they can go off and they can start their careers. So it was this really interesting moment for me of, you know, my God, they're doing it, and this is so much fun. And I want this to be the way it is, but, you know, the nature of the beast, it's temporary.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's part of being a part of the upper academia especially. Is,
right, yeah, yeah. And I'm still new enough that it was like, oh, right, that's the job. You get them ready to fly, and then
they leave the
and
nest.
And they leave you.
That's right, yeah. So, yes, and I can see how this would be an especially important moment for you emotionally, because to have worked with them all this time and to see them coming to this place of excellence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then for you to be able to offer up this really challenging opportunity for them.
Yeah.
That's quite exciting. Say a word about the challenge of portraying the central character of Don Juan.
Right. That, you know, anytime an actor is presented with this kind of level of villain, you know, you have to work to find ways for the audience to still like you. Hmm. You know, I mean, anytime you're playing, especially an iconic, villain might be too strong. I shouldn't call him a villain, an anti-hero. You can't play the bad guy. You know, there's a play called The Libertine. I forget the playwright, but the first line of the play, it's about this very much this Don Juan kind of character. And the first line of the play, it's a monologue, and he looks dead at the audience and says, "You will not like me."
Hmm.
And, you know, and you think, well, thank you, playwright. What a trap. Because now the actor has to find a way to get the audience to like him, even though he's doing these horrible things. You know, and Don Juan, again, iconic, you know, the great romancer, the great duelist. How do you do these despicable things and then still smile at the audience and get that, oh God, he's just so awful, but this is so funny, or I can't believe he did that, but it's kind of fun.
Hmm.
So we're really, you know, Shane and I really looked at this side of Don Juan that, you know, his argument is it's not fair to deny all of these women my love and myself. It shouldn't just go to one woman, you know. And also, you know, that sense of romance. For Don Juan, it's the chase. And it's, you know, it's scaling the castle wall, and it's killing a rival in a sword fight, and it's all of that romance. And then, you know, okay, he won the woman, and now they're sitting across from each other at the dinner table, and she has a headache, and he's living a normal life, and God, this is boring. You know, so we really looked at those kind of his justifications, not as justifications to excuse his bad behavior, but as true, you know, as true belief. This is not what it was supposed to be. And meanwhile, there's a world raging out there with all of these women that I could share my love with. And why would I deny them? You know, and then, of course, poor Scannarelli, he's got this great line where he says, you know, he has something effect of, you know, I'd try it myself if it wasn't wrong. You know, yeah, he's stuck. He's the servant. And servants don't get to say, are you out of your mind? He does, but then he has to find these elaborate and very funny ways of getting himself. You know, every once in a while he'll pop off. There's one moment where he tells Don Juan he's wrong and then realizes, oh God, what have I just said?
Yeah.
And has to, you know, has to kind of manipulate his way. You know, he's a slippery character because he has to be, is old Scannarelle, played by Jared Langwinski.
Well, there are all kinds of reasons for us to take in this great classic. You know, it's one of those classics that nevertheless is not done all that often.
Absolutely,
and it is not. There's a very good likelihood that every single person listening to this interview has never seen this play done.
Safe bet.
Right, yeah. So this is a rare opportunity to encounter a really important work, Molière's comedy, Don Juan. Brian, if people are interested in attending performances either this weekend or next weekend, what should they do?
They can call 262-595-2564, which is the box office. They can also order online at uwparksidetickets.com.
Very good.
And they will be helped out.
Molière's Don Juan opens this weekend, and its director, Brian Gill. Brian, this was fun. Thank you so much. Best wishes to you and